This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things walking, wheeling. And I might have got that in the wrong order, but it doesn't matter. You get the idea. Dedicated to active travel. I'm Ned Bolting.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And today we don't have Laura Laker. Which is going to be interesting. We're feeling a bit odd, just
yeah,
the two of us.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Yeah, we're just two blokes in a room staring at each other.
Well, that's classic podcast behaviour, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, this might be the winning formula. Sorry, Laura. This might just propel us to the very top of the charts.
I don't think it will be.
Yeah. The reason being that I think Laura has had her head deep in documents and has been picking to bits, I would imagine, kind of in our little world of active travel, the news story that broke over the weekend that we've been called into action to you and I just to do this sort of emergency podcast, if you like, just to get a bit of reaction out to the government's initiative that was announced by the Secretary of State for Transport, Mark Harper. I think Laura Kunzberg's flagship programme on BBC One, wasn't it, on Sunday morning. This is what he had to say.
Now, you're making an announcement today, what you're calling a crackdown on anti-road driver schemes in England. Now, we understand you're referring to what are known as low-traffic neighbourhoods. A lot of people, lots of people have them where they live, whether it's bollards or planters at the end of their roads or just, you know, go-slow schemes. What do you mean by cracking down on this?
Well, it's really about the schemes where councils haven't taken their communities with them. So, look, if a council puts in place a scheme and it's about trying to properly balance drivers and other road users and they consult people properly and in the proper sense of that word and they take their local community with them and the scheme is popular, we don't have a problem with that. That's fine. But we know there are specific examples and we've seen them in the country. There's one in Jesmond in Newcastle. We've just seen one recently at Streatham Wells in London, which have had to be withdrawn.
Where the council have decided to get rid of them.
Where the council didn't take people with it, didn't have local consent, pitted drivers against other road users. That's what we're trying to crack down on. So we're publishing statutory guidance to say to councils, you need to try and take communities with you. You need not to pit drivers against other road users.
But hang on, you refer to the report. In all areas, this is a quote from your report, in all areas, a higher proportion of residents were supportive than opposed.
Yes, but if you have a very significant proportion of people don't feel supportive of those schemes, and for example, there were quotes there from emergency services suggesting that lives could be put at risk because some schemes haven't been properly thought through, that's a problem. So look, this is about sensible government, right? This is about making sure that communities are properly listened to. I've listened to people from communities where some of these schemes have been in place, where councils haven't listened to them. Where a local council is properly listening to its local community, does its consultation properly, and we've set out some examples in our statutory guidance about how you go about doing that, then no one has a problem. But I think it should be possible for people who walk, cycle, use public transport, and drivers to sensibly coexist.
So, Adam, we get the idea, a plan for drivers. It feels like to me, you know, unlike you and Laura, perhaps, you know, who follow this every sort of move, it feels like I've heard stuff like this maybe informally quite often on the airwaves, but this seems to suggest that there's a bit more of a formal policy approach here.
Yeah, you've heard, the reason it sounds like you've heard it before is because you have heard it before.
Right.
And it was announced back in 2023 when the plan for drivers was originally mooted and launched with a fanfare as well. And one of the key pledges within that was to review low traffic neighbourhoods. And that was, you know, a review instructed by the Prime Minister effectively and completed by the Department for Transport. That report came out on Sunday, along with a load of rhetoric alongside LTNs, not just LTNs, 20 mile an hour zones, bus lane fines, et cetera, et cetera. And the rhetoric was pretty, you know, pretty bold. And from their point of view, you know, that there was no ambiguity that they see votes in somehow defining people as drivers rather than sort of human beings that are just going about the place in the best way possible for them.
To stop you there. I mean, that suggests that you've concluded that they are motivated. I mean, it's not an unreasonable conclusion, but that they're motivated principally by elections coming up or popularity or vote winning rather than policy. Is that fair to them? I mean, is there a consistent thread that they're following here that extends perhaps beyond just chasing votes in the short term?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's pretty plain to see. The politics of it, you know, linked towards what's happened in Wales with their default urban speed limit being 20 miles an hour and that being called a blanket speed limit in Wales. And also, obviously, what we saw in London with the expansion of ULEZ and the Uxbridge by-election.
Yeah.
It's a continuation of that. And the reason I think it's, sort of boldly political and not policy-driven is there was this just fascinating mismatch between the low traffic neighbourhood report, you know, nearly 80 pages of it, and very little seemed to correlate with the actual press release that came out. So there were some bold statements about cracking down on anti-driver measures, about delays to ambulances, etc. Whereas actually, if you read the report, being generous, the view is a lot more nuanced than that. And in many cases shows that these low traffic neighbourhoods are more popular than more people support them than oppose them, which is not the view that you would get if you read the government press release.
All right, well, we'll come on to that in a bit of detail later, what actually came out in the report. I mean, but a couple of things first. One is, where in the course of the interview that you obviously watched, Laura Koonsberg interview was the report, which is, as you said, after all, a government report, was it referenced?
Yes.
Which aspects were brought out in order to sort of validate the government's position?
Well, I think what you heard Laura Koonsberg challenge the Secretary of State for Transport, Mark Harper, on was the fact that there is more support than opposition for these schemes. And part of the narrative and, you know, that the government was pushing is that these schemes are not popular. They don't have consent of the general population. And further than that, not many people are consulted or feel that their voices are heard. But there are obviously some challenges, and not all of those things can be true. And even if people's voice, you know, people feel like their voice isn't heard, you're never going to get unanimity in all schemes. So someone's voice isn't going to feel like they've been heard, because ultimately you've got to make a choice. And that's the case with consultations. Shouldn't be referendums, but ultimately decisions are made and some people will disagree and some people will agree. No decision in this sphere, or in fact any sphere, has probably ever had 100% support, because politicians don't have 100% support. But it's cherry picking the kind of people's voices that they think are most important. And that's where the motoring underlying the drivers, we are on the side of drivers, explicitly said, feels like it's more important than the whole view of the, you know, the area of the population that was actually surveyed by the government's polling company.
Well, in terms of the rhetoric used, and you followed it up with other media interview rounds, I would imagine, and just actually a few minutes before we started recording this podcast on Monday evening, London mayoral candidate Susan Hall just posted an interview with Mark Harper that we've looked at, standing by the cycle lane in Park Lane by the looks of it, bemoaning its lack of use, etc. And Mark Harper, in his brief answer that was posted online, used to, and here's a bit of a contradiction, is that used the kind of label for the report, or the policy, is the plan for drivers, and then almost in the same breath talked about the need to balance the needs of all road users, use a rather unfortunate preposition, and went on to say drivers against cyclists, which is
probably not quite what you meant,
but you get the idea. But even that, notwithstanding that slightly unfortunate phrasing, there is, I think, where I would agree with you, there seems to be a kind of complete mismatch between talking about enhancing the experience and the opportunities and the effectiveness and the provision for all road users in the context of a policy that is called the Plan for Drivers.
Yeah.
That's where the rhetoric falls down, right?
Yeah, and the gaslighting, which is frankly what it is, you know, if you look at the government press release, it's tagged walking and cycling. So when you go into the walking and cycling section of the Department for Transport website, you're presented with the Plan for Drivers as if you are almost meant to be thankful for it.
Yeah.
So there is this, to be fair, a lot of the rhetoric isn't as bad as it could be, frankly, in the kind of political world that we live in with the way that politics is now, where everything's a fight.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is an acceptance that we want to support all road users. But I think the real disconnect is when you talk about balancing the needs for all road users, you kind of need to have just that balance. So that you know, that Park Lane thing we were just looking at, it's got two lanes of traffic, it's got bus lanes, and it's got a cycle lane. And it's got a place in the park for when it's light and for leisure and recreational cyclists that want to mix with pedestrians.
Yes.
It's a perfect balance of all road users.
That's a very sticky bit of infrastructure and has been ever since we started doing this podcast. I think, you know, it's not without its nuance and complexity, that particular stretch. I mean, we could have a debate. We could probably fill a whole podcast on that on its own, because I don't, to some extent, this is just a little thing, but I don't think necessarily it's perfect. But so it does provide a bit of fertile territory for them to stand there and make these kinds of points. But this may be outside of your remit and your understanding, but you've kind of opened the door to the suggestion that, and we'll get onto the detail of the report, because I think it's very important soon, but you've opened the door to the suggestion this is just naked politicking. Certainly that's the accusation you've laid at the... And also, by the way, I think we also need to say opposition parties, Labour Party included, aren't necessarily kind of... what's the word I'm after?
Well, they're not...
They've sort of fell into the trap, really, and that's the politics of it. I don't know what they said. So, but let's talk about the government, because they're the people with the levers on power at the moment. So,
I think when you're interested and involved in active travel, as we all are on this podcast, you're hyper aware that every bit of narrative around, you know, the so-called war on drivers or whatever it might be, and also, you know, the undercurrent of effectively saying that we're not that supportive of measures to improve cycling or public transport, and actually it just gets in the way of the serious business of driving a car, you make every journey on a bike a little bit less safe, ultimately. And there will be councils that are in the middle, you know, probably not so much the ones that I have experience working with, but there will be councils in the country that are on the fence with this stuff, and they will see this as a, I don't know, you know, we were going to have a cycle lane to make kids cycling to school more safe.
Yeah.
But they're right, you know, we could annoy quite a lot of people you know, is it worth it if not even the government's going to support us on this? So it does make it feel, you know, a little bit less safe, frankly. I don't want to sound like it's hyperbole, but ultimately, you know, whenever there's these stories in the national media in a big way, and cycling's featured, you kind of feel a little bit less safe when you're out on the road because of the rhetoric.
Agreed. And the temperature of the debate, etc., and you are in a vulnerable position. But sorry, the question I was really long-windedly trying to get around to asking you is, do you actually think there are votes in it? Because we've got this kind of, this one day of voting that seems to occupy and balloon out to occupy this huge space in Tory party policy thinking of the Uxbridge by-election and the anti-ULEZ vote. And it seems to have kind of filtered through a lot of thinking. And I don't know, but they might be right. They might be right.
Yeah, I mean, I will not claim to be a political strategist of any type. But having observed what some actual political strategists have said, is that when it comes to how the Conservatives could cling on or could avoid a huge defeat. It's going to be votes in areas more to the right, so leaning into developing these contrast points between Labour and the Conservatives, and that's ultimately what we've seen with the references to Wales and London, like I mentioned.
Mm.
In terms of, it doesn't feel like it's going to be an election of the sort of centre ground, because that the strategy seemingly for the Conservatives is to kind of push on big topics, immigration, all of those things outside of active travel, which won't feature in the election really.
Yeah,
but it's sort of fascinating that, you know, in a key media moment, because you sort of make a choice to sit on the Laura Kay sofa and do a big announcement, that they think there is enough votes in this. And I just cannot see it, because the opinion polling doesn't
I wonder though, Adam, because the feeling is that the general election, maybe sometime off, maybe closer than we think, who knows, no one knows, but we do know that the local elections are just around the corner, and this maybe is a policy which will have more impact in the local elections, where issues like this have much more traction in certain councils and certain wards within those councils.
Yeah, it's
so
interesting.
Perhaps that somewhat explains some of the timing.
Yeah, potentially. I think, but it is unusual.
It's not a national issue. It's not going to be on the agenda, doesn't it?
I don't know, it isn't, but that's how
it feels.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's unusual that our top politicians are interested in the placement of bollards in local authority areas. Like, if we're just frank about it, that is a sort of unprecedented, probably, per position to be involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's address the report itself. What was the scope of the report as it was instructed by government back in last year?
Yeah, so there's the Low Traffic Neighbourhood Report, and we will put it in the show notes so you can read all 79 pages or so, or whatever it is. The interesting thing was a kind of, you know, I think in the industry they call it a rapid evidence assessment, where they kind of pool and collate a lot of the research together. And also they did some of their own research and polling. One of the arguments that's been laid down is that local authorities have not followed their duty in consulting with residents. And the really interesting thing is that the government hired a polling company to consult with residents in the way that they would describe as best practice. And that polling returned a result of effectively, roughly across the board of four low traffic neighbourhood areas, a 2-to-1 ratio of support versus opposition. And that was done by posting letters to every household, both within the low traffic neighbourhood and also outside the low traffic neighbourhood within a sensible area, covering off some boundary roads, covering off the areas. So not just the people who are like, I'm all right, this is lovely in here.
Yeah.
But also people who don't have the benefits of low traffic in the streets. And even then, two things. One is that 2-to-1 support, but also the average response rate from the letters posted to people filling out the survey was 15%. And that's the government doing it to the best standards that they are putting across.
Well, that sounds like quite a low percentage. But is it? I don't know. Is it or not?
This is just it. So these vague terms are being used of community consent, or it needs to have, you know, popularity or whatever. But what does that mean? You know, that 18% figure that we heard Mark Harper talk about, of 18% of people don't feel like their voices were heard in a consultation. But if you follow the best practice guidance, which the government has laid out in their updated draft 85% guidance,
85% of people
not interested. You can't compel people to engage in something. And therefore, how do you monitor and how do you count the ambivalence effectively, you know, because people go and vote every 4 years or so for a candidate to go and broadly go and do stuff in their local area.
Yeah.
Not everybody, well, not most people want to go and get involved in a hyper-local democratic process. It's a challenge, right? Because the government's putting out this guidance saying you need to consult more.
Yeah.
But when they had the opportunity to consult with residents,
they got the same
reply that didn't fit their agenda and also didn't get as many people responding to it. So that's a real challenge.
So that came back in the report. And I did see the numbers, Adam. They were quite low. As you said, 15%.
Yeah.
It was in the hundreds of respondents, wasn't it?
So each area had about 3,200 households.
York.
Yes, York, Birmingham. London, and gosh, you've got
somewhere
me.
Else. Okay, well, yeah, but all showing roughly within. I mean, it was more or less on the along similar lines.
Birmingham had the lowest response rate of 10%, and York had the highest of 19%. So again, even in areas, it differs hugely about how people will engage with this process. But you can't, you know, there was a, you know, I think it's fair to say there was a moment in time during COVID where local authorities would install these schemes and then sort of consult afterwards.
Yep.
But that was, and this is the other, I think local authorities would feel really hard done by here, is that that was as a result of the actual government funding saying that you had to begin delivery within 4 weeks of the funding being issued.
Yeah.
And even the guidance on consultation said to use what's called experimental traffic regulation orders and to consult afterwards as a trial.
Yeah.
And that has a lot to answer for, really, because it's made people feel like they haven't been listened to. But I think possibly, I know they would say it's a different government now, but I think it's worth stating that actually local authorities were told to do this and now they're in a predicament where they're being told off for doing it, which doesn't feel that fair.
Yeah. And just as a side note, it may be a different government now, but you tend to have general elections, don't you, to elect different governments, and that feels like it was a long time ago. Going back to the scope of the report, that was about acceptance of LTNs.
Yeah, and also looking at the data and the evidence assessment. And I think I've seen, you know, followed some of the critics as well, which, you know, I'm genuinely interested because the evidence isn't conclusive. This is a new topic. It's something where there hasn't been a huge evidence base like lots of other areas of transport. But the thing I kind of, you know, I find very frustrating is just when the fact that it is nuanced or that it is inconclusive or doesn't appear to show any issues is ignored for the kind of what comes across in the press release, which is ultimately a political exercise.
Yeah.
So able to say that, you know, we're concerned that low traffic neighbourhoods are delaying ambulances, whereas if you read the report, it clearly says there is not evidence for low traffic neighbourhoods delaying emergency response times. It's just there, laid there for everyone to see.
All right, so that's the conclusion reached in the report about that, because that's a very thorny issue. That raises its head a lot in this.
Yeah, discussion. And there will be instances, there will be bad schemes where they didn't engage with the local ambulance service, and the first couple of times they were like, well, what's going on here? We didn't know about this.
Yeah.
But on the whole, you know, that the evidence seems to suggest in their own report that that's not the case.
Yeah. From what I understand, Adam, not all of the evidence is entirely positive about LTNs. There is evidence, is that right, that the report flagged up that that pollution on boundary roads is measurably up?
So on the boundary road topic, they said that it wasn't actually referenced in pollution, to the best of my knowledge. Obviously, it's a wide-ranging report. The bit that stuck out and has been pulled out by people who are for and against low traffic neighbourhoods is that the low traffic neighbourhoods are effective in achieving outcomes of reducing traffic volumes within internal roads. However, results for boundary roads are mixed, with some seeing increases in traffic volumes.
Okay.
So if you dig into that a little bit, you've got some evidence. You know, I've seen data in Islington, for example, which has shown a net decrease in boundary road traffic. So
why would that be, do you think?
Well,
I mean, speculating at the reason why that is, if that's the evidence, seems a bit counterintuitive. If you close a bunch of roads to through traffic for motor cars and then the boundary roads, the traffic drops, that would suggest that fewer people are choosing to drive in that whole area.
Yeah, and this is the bit that is challenging, because the evidence and what the hypotheses, if you like, of what happens, which is called traffic evaporation, is quite hard to believe. And I also accept that, you know, the idea that it is harder to drive, more inconvenient, less direct to drive, and therefore people eventually start to go, well, actually, I'm going to use a different mode of transport because it's not as convenient as it was, leads to fewer people using their cars, which leads to fewer vehicles both inside the low traffic neighbourhood but also visiting on the boundary roads. Some boundary roads are up, And sometimes it does go wrong. You know, we've seen...
Streatham?
Yeah, well, you've seen stuff happen in Streatham, again, around implementation. Mm. And also, you know, I have seen some boundary roads up by 10, 12%, which is a lot to take in one go.
Yeah.
Again, this is like with anything. It's like there are good schemes and bad schemes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just sort of opposing them wholeheartedly is not going to be a popular thing, I don't think, for anybody.
Although that's not what they're saying out loud, is it? The government are not saying we oppose low traffic neighbourhoods. They maybe the quiet thing that they're not saying, but they are saying...
Well, they've openly withdrawn funding for them. So they've openly sort of removed them from the criteria.
Okay, that's quite an oppositional thing to do.
For funding. And I think they probably have said as much. I won't want to put words into their mouths, but I think, you know, you've had conversations in media that says, you know, these are not in keeping with, well, originally it was not in keeping with British values, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But
going back to the London mayoral election as well, I think the Conservative candidate is quite vocally, you're right, actually, quite overtly anti-LTE.
Yeah, but you know, Mark Harper, to his credit,
didn't say that.
Yeah. And you know, I think despite the funding being withdrawn, talks about well consulted schemes.
Yeah.
But that then links back to the point that we've just discussed, which is a lot of councils are already consulting very, very thoroughly. It's their bread and butter. It's what they do, and they're now sort of being accused in public of being, you know, on the sly, you know, squeezing schemes through. And that's sort of just not the case. And you know, I speak my own area in Coventry. They've done tons of engagement around a low traffic neighbourhood there. And actually it's led to some fairly significant changes. You could argue that it's now won't be as effective with the, you know, certain closures being moved or being removed altogether. But, you know, it's having a 20-mile-an-hour zone across 41 different roads. And you look at the consultation report and the majority of people say, I'm supportive of the 20-mile-an-hour zone. So they've been consulted, but there's still a massive debate going on in my local area at the weekend on BBC Midlands Today, BBC Politics Midlands, sort of talking about blanket 20-mile-an-hour zones and is Coventry about to become like Wales, like it's a bad thing. And I think we've lost sight that this is about... Well, it's about physics, probably, for 20-mile-an-hour zones and about road safety. And again, it comes back to that thing, like, feels like everything's feeling a bit less safe if we are vilifying sort of 20-mile-an-hour zones.
What else was in the report?
So, as well as, you know, the evidence on boundary roads, there was important sections on disabled access and again, mixed, because disabled people are not a homogenous group. So some people's freedom is vastly increased by low traffic neighbourhoods because of, you know, things like pavement parking,
yep.
You know, busy roads, antisocial driving, those kind of things. And some people who rely on their cars that don't have blue badge exemptions, perhaps in their local authority with the scheme, would feel hard done by. So again, at best, the picture is mixed. And this comes back to this sort of overarching philosophy that no one's saying that every scheme is perfect or every scheme is awful. Anyone that's pragmatic wouldn't believe that. But the narrative that's being put across is effectively that some views are more important than others under the guise of lack of consultation. So what they mean is ultimately people who don't like it, who are ultimately drivers using neighbourhoods as rat runs, their voice isn't being heard, and that's why we're on the side of drivers. And doing that ignores, you know, in my area, the near 30% of people who don't have access to a car and the 60% of people who said, actually, I'd quite like to cycle more if there was better infrastructure. So if we do genuinely think that this is about all road users and all of that stuff, then we actually probably need to define a bit more about what a balanced transport system looks like, rather than just anything that gets in the way of important cars is a problem.
Yeah. Did the report look just at LTNs, or did it have a broader scope?
Yeah. So there was several bits thrown out in all one foul swoop in the news.
Yeah, because you mentioned
day.
That your menu at the top, you said something about
20 mile an hour,
floating bus stops
and also really, you know, really interestingly, and frustratingly around bus lane enforcement.
Yeah.
And the, again, another narrative. So I've been working a lot in road safety. We've talked about it a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest issues we have in road safety is that there is no funding, sustainable funding levels to do speeding enforcement via average speed cameras and things like that. And that is because, you know, several years ago, the media managed to build a narrative of this war on motorists and motorists being a cash cow.
Yeah.
So what the government at the time did was decide to take all fines from speeding cameras and send them straight to Treasury in Westminster. So we're in a point where we're getting lots of emails now, lots of people saying, we want more speed cameras in our area. Our roads don't feel safe. People are speeding. You know, average speed cameras are what we need. You've got communities telling us that. And it's very hard to build a business case that sustains the investment for this over 5 or 10 years because you don't get any of the ongoing revenue or maintenance costs. And
yeah,
on the bus lanes, basically the proposition in the foreword from the Secretary of State again is that, you know, there's a suggestion that motorists are being used as a cash cow for bus lane fines, bus lane infringement, yellow box infringements, the kind of thing that keep our transport networks moving. And one suggestion would be that we take the fines that normally go to local authorities and send them again straight to Treasury to prevent local authorities from profiteering from these kind of infractions that then go on to be funding other parts of the transport network. And that's exactly the same situation with speed cameras. And frankly, local authorities don't feel like they're very well funded right now.
Well, half of them are bankrupt.
Well, and Waltham Forest, Clyde Lokes, you know, who we had on this show, you know, he was quoted in The Guardian saying, well, that funding funds my freedom passes for young and old people and disabled people to have free public transport.
Yeah.
And if you take that away from me, I'm not going to be able to offer those people. Yeah. And
so just to reiterate, that's come about because it's behoven on the local councils to put these speed cameras and the kit in and to maintain it.
Yeah, so that's the initial issue, which is quite an old issue now.
It's quite expensive.
Yeah, so we can't afford to do it.
The fines go to the central government.
Yeah, and that's what they're proposing with bus lanes. So at the moment now the funds stay in the local authority area. They have to be spent on transport schemes.
Yeah.
They can't be used to pay for social care or anything like that.
That's really interesting. I've been doing this podcast with you and Laura for years, and I'd never really heard that. And it sounds quite significant to me.
It's a massive, you know, it's a massive amount of money. And you could argue that it does sound like profiteering, but ultimately, if you allow your roads to become a free-for-all and you don't have any enforcement, you don't, you know, have yellow box junctions, you know, that's not a plan for drivers. That's, you know, the plan for drivers, as I made the point before on social media, is to provide people with genuine choices and a good transport network that moves freely.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to load in as many people as you can in private vehicles to get a few votes that then will bring it to gridlock. That's not a plan for drivers.
A plan for drivers is to get people out of cars, isn't it?
Exactly. So that people need to use their car can actually use it.
Moves.
And that's the bit that's so frustrating. And just to come on to the politics, if you like, of it, we've talked a lot about what the Conservatives' view is. I've got to say it's not all Conservatives. You know, there's a lot of sensible voices out there, and I thought
within the Conservative Party,
and my boss, the Mayor of the West Midlands, Andy Street, you know, feel this is not going to change our local strategy where we have devolution, but it is going to affect some of those areas. And I guess if you look at more broadly to that political discourse of what's going to happen leading up to a general election, what was disappointing, you know, regardless of your politics, is, you know, the Labour Party are sort of falling into this trap. So rather than call it out on the Laura Kay show, Jonathan Ashworth, you know, was when asked in the media round afterwards, basically said, oh, yes, the Conservative Party, you know, aren't even keeping their own Tory councils into line with these policies. So rather than say, this is a load of nonsense, we support sustainable transport and choice, they made a political dig of saying, well, actually, this is disingenuous because there are Conservative councils out there installing 20-mile-an-hour zones. How bad is that?
Yeah. Well, there'll be many listeners, I think, who making their minds up about how they will vote, to for whom that won't be a great surprise. I think that that's been the first approach from the main opposition party and the government in waiting.
Mm. And it's not good, is it?
It's going to lead to a race
to the bottom of what we want out of a transport system.
And it was on Sadiq Khan's behest, as well. He's facing this election fairly soon, wasn't it? That the Streatham LTN, he called time on it as well, wasn't he, as far as I'm concerned, and said, right, let's scrap that.
Yeah, it really caught momentum.
Although that may, as we discussed in that particular case, may have been the right thing to do, but it probably means that an altered LTN or a different kind of LTN in that same area is some way off being reinstalled.
I think the challenge is that there's going to, you know, there are some people celebrating its pausing and / removal, but actually one of the main reasons they're stopping and removing it is because they're about to do loads of roadworks, building cycle lanes on Streatham High Street.
Right.
So I'm not sure that's going to massively appease the people that might
should just say in positive news that the London cycle, a segregated cycleway from London Bridge to Greenwich, for the most part, is now fully open. It's been
built for brilliant,
isn't
it?
And it's absolutely outstandingly good quality.
Yeah.
It's a model, really.
I mean, people
totally use it, yeah.
This is the bit I can't get my head around sometimes, you know, in cities like London, that there is such a conversation. You know, we should be far past the idea that cars are great things, cars are freedom machines, but when everyone's got one, they're perfect in low density areas like the countryside where you know there aren't many choices. But in a city like London or a city like Birmingham, I can't believe we're still having a conversation like private cars are still a viable mode of transport, because everything we've done for 70 years has suggested that that's not the case. But no one's looking at that going, oh, that's sustainable. What we need is more of those cars here, because that's going to help.
I drive so infrequently in London. I had to drive yesterday evening in a zip car, in a little car. I just now, because I do it so infrequently, I kind of almost physically can't compute when I come to a halt, as I do every 200 meters, because there's a line of cars in front of me, because as a cyclist, I simply don't have to do that. I stop at red lights, but I can always go to the front, pretty much always, you know. And so that I just recoil at the sense of being inhibited in my plans. But every time I get behind the wheel of a car in London,
that's really just a born experience of
a long time of kind of understanding the difference.
And if the people who didn't need to drive used the alternatives, I said the other day, it would be like driving on a school holiday,
which is
every single day.
Such a colossal
difference. If we took 25% of unnecessary car journeys off the road, it would make a massive difference. That's the plan for drivers, not trying to say cram us in like sardines, and everyone has their own individual freedoms, which in reality is not freedom because you're stuck in traffic.
All right. Talking about, as we sort of wind this up, because as I say, it's a short emergency pod, just you and me. It'd be good to get Laura's take next time we pod. But really, how much of what came out of Mark Carper's mouth is actually going to change anything?
Yeah, I think very little, because actually, as I say, the report and the draft guidance is eminently sensible. It says things like you should consult with communities, which is what's happening, you know, anyway. I think the reality of that is that most local authorities do play by those rules and do, I'm not saying they can't do a better job, but do a decent job in terms of consultation. So in terms of the guidance itself, you know, the guidance is, I've read nothing in that guidance that is going to fundamentally change the way that local authorities operate, because that's sort of what they do. They might just feel a bit gaslit by being told in public that they don't.
Which, yeah.
In terms of the bus lane stuff, that's sort of worrying, because, you know, I've looked at the consultation and how you fill it in, and it's very much aimed at motorists saying, I think it's unfair that I'm fined, rather than hearing from, you know, people who've got to keep a transport network moving at rush hour or whatever. So I'd encourage, I know we have local authority people listen to the podcast, I'd encourage people to make representations to that consultation, because, you know, the future of our bus service and therefore, you know, congestion and all those things rely on it, not least the proper funding that they need to kind of keep the system moving. So and the 20 mile an hour stuff, I mean, we talked about this before in previous pods, but it's just the idea of not allowing what's happening in Wales to happen in England is sort of a sideshow, because the government is in control of the default urban speed limit. So the thing that Wales has done is they've changed their default urban speed limit through devolution to 20. Now, the only people with the power to do that as a blanket way, as described by some people, would be for the government to do it. So at the moment, you have a situation where the only way local authorities can deliver blanket, let's just use their phrase, 20-mile-an-hour zones in a city would be to sign them all individually, which is really, really, really expensive and out of reach for most people. So you're effectively going up against something that doesn't exist. And, you know, the same reason before when there was, you know, that conversation about Labour wants to stop you eating meat or whatever. It's like, well, nobody's actually stopping me doing that, are they?
Seven bins,
that was the one.
Seven bins.
So it's not going to make a load of difference, but it will make every single time we want to put a 20-mile-an-hour zone anywhere but other than outside of school, because people don't just live in, like, they don't just go to school and they just pop up there. They have to travel to school, typically about 2 miles on average. So we need 20 zones in places where people live, walk, cross, shop, you know, work, not just outside schools. So installing those is going to be made much, much harder because of this rhetoric. So it will make a difference in that respect for those who are easily swayed, I would say.
Well, keep your pecker up. Sounds like another sort of slight setback in the great march forward, the great leap forward.
Not how I wanted to spend my Sunday.
Yeah, I bet. Well, more power to you anyway. And you've stated the case, I think, very clearly. And for anyone who wants to read the report for themselves, we'll put it, put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And read it. Make your own mind up as well. I think, you know, I'm not here to tell you what to think. I think the report's a really good way to look at all the different arguments that there are.
All right. Okay. Well, that was a special pod. Next time we resume, don't know in what form or quite when. Hopefully Laura will be back in tow. But in the meantime, you've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor, as ever, has been Claire Mansell. Thank you, Claire. And as ever, the call to arms is rate us, review us, like us, share us on social media. And indeed, if you're feeling really behind the cause, then drop us a couple of a limited amount of money, a tiny amount of money.
Yeah, tiny.
On Patreon. All those things are possible and linked to in our show notes. But for me, Ned Bolting, and from you,
Adam Tranter,
it's bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.